Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com. The following program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery. Cane Vineyard and Winery supports Heritage Radio and the growing movement to change how Americans eat and how we think about our planet. For more information, visit www.cane5.com.
You're listening to Cutting the Curd, hosted by Ann Saxelby. You're listening to Cutting the Curd, hosted by Ann Saxelby. You're listening to Cutting the Curd, hosted by Ann Saxelby, broadcast live to the cosmos on the Heritage Radio Network.
Happy New Year, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Cutting the Curd on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Ann Saxelby. My co-host and producer is Sophie Schlesinger.
Hello.
And with us in the studio today, he might or might not talk, is Patrick Martins, host of The Main Course on the Heritage Radio Network.
It's an honor to sit in.
So, if we thought it would only be appropriate for the new year to... Yes. Do a little bit of a roundup show to talk about our favorite shows from 2011 and also talk about some cheese news that's happened in 2011 and some new stuff, you know, that that's going to happen this coming year.
Yeah, and a couple of check-ins with some guests of the past year.
Exactly, yeah, people we talked to that are, you know, up to great stuff, so it'll be great to check back in with them. And we're also going to be talking about the health merits of cheese because it's New Year's and everyone's doing their resolutions, and we firmly resolved to eat more cheese in 2011 because it's actually good for you.
Yeah, we can prove it.
Yeah. We have a lot of reputable sources. Yes. Well, before we get started, if anybody, we've had a lot of great emails lately. If you have email or, you know, questions for us, ideas for shows, you can always send us an email at info@heritageradionetwork.com, and we really appreciate the ideas and the responses that we've gotten.
Yeah, and you can tweet us too, at Saxelby Cheese. We've been getting some great tweets lately, which is fun and quick.
And I don't know how to use Twitter, so Sophie keeps track of all that stuff.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's start with our top episodes of 2011.
Yes, so we've chosen three that we kind of felt were, I don't know, a little interesting, really different, and I'd say a little more holistic in looking at cheese and how it's relevant.
Exactly. Right, as opposed to just, you know, interviews, which are great. We there were a couple shows that tackled bigger issues. Our first pick was episode number 78, which is Small Cheese Occupies Big Food. So I guess we're going to play a short clip from that episode, and then we're going to talk a little bit about what's going on with Occupy Big Food at the moment.
I've been working on farmer justice issues for a long time, and I would have to say that dairy blogs have a lot of commentary about Occupy Wall Street and what it might mean to us as farmers. I don't know if you heard, we didn't have much coverage in the media, but last year there were the Obama administration held hearings on antitrust issues in dairy, and what were the major issues, the market consolidation. You probably know that a few large companies totally dominate how milk is priced in the United States. At the hearings, there was some really compelling testimony from the Food Marketing Policy Center out of the University of Connecticut, Dr. Ron Cotterill. The share of the dairy retail basket that actually finds its way back to the farmer has dropped, and that drop has accelerated in the past decade. In 2002, the farmers were receiving, you know, around 42% of the money back that the consumer spent in the store. That by 2009, that figure had dropped to 27%. The Chicago Mercantile Exchange actually sets the base price of milk. And, you know, since you're involved in cheese, you probably heard about the Chicago Merc. The spread from what the farmers get has increased dramatically since that Chicago Merc began setting our prices. The spread initially was around $1.49. So if the Chicago Merc paid $1.50 for cheese, you maybe see $1.49 markup. The markup now that is over $3.99 a pound. So the spread keeps widening. So So we farmers in New York State, there are about 6,000 of us, are in a terrible crunch. We have no control over the price of our milk. It's essentially priced far away. We are waiting for the Obama administration to get back to us as to any findings from the dairy antitrust hearings. The hearings were held, and that was it. We never heard from them again.
So that was Lorraine Lewandowski, who is a prolific Twitter user. If anyone wants to follow her, she's a really fascinating woman.
NY Farmer is her Twitter handle.
NY Farmer. So we asked Lorraine today if she could give us an idea of what is kind of going on in dairy in New York currently, and she had some interesting things to say.
Yeah, she pretty much summed it up in one word, yogurt. Some of our listeners might know Chobani and Faye have yogurt plants here in upstate New York and employ a lot of people in these smaller towns and are buying a lot of the milk that's in New York. And also, kind of a newer development, PepsiCo is building a brand new facility upstate that will be pretty big. It's probably going to employ a couple hundred people and increase the competition, I guess, for yogurt in New York.
New York State milk, yeah. Well, it's an interesting thing because Lorraine also cited that, when we were interviewing her, she was talking about Chobani being a hopeful thing in New York State because they were paying better prices and the milk was being purchased locally and processed locally, so the money was staying in the community a little bit more. It's pretty fascinating. She said that in 2000, there were 25.2 million pounds of yogurt produced in New York State. And in 2010, there were 369 million pounds of yogurt produced in New York State. So it's pretty awesome. It's a big growing industry. And it's kind of an interesting question because Occupy Big Food, Pepsi, I would definitely say, is big food.
Yeah, pretty big.
But who knows, getting an injection of, sort of extra economic vitality into the New York State dairy market, could be a good thing. So we were asking Lorraine about the pricing, how would that work? Mm-hmm. And she was basically saying if there's more competition for New York State milk, hopefully that means good things for the price of milk. Yeah. It'll keep going up.
And hopefully. But let us know what you think. You can join in the conversation on Twitter or you can send us an email.
And so the other people that participated in that show were Tia Keenan and Heather Squire. Tia Keenan is a really excellent cheese lover and chef, and Heather Squire was the chef of the Occupy Wall Street People's Kitchen, and we've been trying to keep up with them as well. And Occupy Big Food, we saw today, they are going to be having a nationwide day of action at the end of February. I don't think they've named the date yet, but if you check up on their blog, occupybigfood.wordpress.com, you can participate in some way. All right, so that is
episode 78.
Episode 78, and moving on, our another episode we wanted to talk about was episode 67, which was still life paintings in the Dutch Golden Age. We had Professor Julie Hochstrasser from the University of Iowa on the show, and we will play a short clip from her.
Yeah, I'm always reminded of, how delicious these paintings are. I get busy, studying about the social and cultural history, and then students look at the pictures and say, oh, this is making me hungry. It reminds me that, I do think that people at the time, found pleasure in them and also took great pride in, the kinds of things that were pictured that were really significant to the Dutch economy, like cheese, actually, is one of those.
So that's actually kind of an interesting tie-in, talking about, Occupy Big Food, how the dairy economy is working today. Mm-hmm. Those paintings in 17th century Holland, they were about the Dutch economy as well, because the Dutch were, of course, a nation of traders, which they still are to this day.
Yep.
And so, in their paintings, they wanted to basically show off the best of their food culture, which was their cheese and butter and other decadent dairy products.
Yeah, and then it gave historians, studying the paintings later on, an insight into what was economically more profitable for them during the time, which is really cool.
And how the value is perceived now. I don't think if you asked anybody to make a painting now of what's significant in the American economy, anyone would paint, a big, beautiful wheel of cheese. But hopefully that's changing But so I loved that show also because I have an art background, and I feel like it was just really cool to get a deeper lens into those paintings, which are very physically beautiful, but also have such kind of intricate social messages.
Yeah. And I think too, we're always talking about the art and the science of cheese, and anytime that we can, you know, cite an academic source of where this is being studied is really great. And then tying in economics as well is pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. We love Julie Hochstrasser. Our third episode that we wanted to mention, one of our favorites from 2011, was episode 77, which featured Blue Heron Farm, and was a show about wildfires that were actually a really big problem in Texas earlier in the year. Mm-hmm. And Christian and Lisa Seeger, goat farmers and cheesemakers, heroically took in their neighbors, and all their neighbors, their neighbors' children, yeah, and their neighbors' goats.
Their neighbors in every sense of the word.
In every sense of the word, and made cheese 24 hours a day around the clock so that they wouldn't have to throw the milk away, and like they could actually, you know, make some sort of an economic gain out of this terrible natural disaster.
Yep.
So we'll listen to a quick clip from them.
You know, we were doing okay, kind of getting along, and then Labor Day weekend, the fire started in our area. Previously, there was a huge fire out in Bastrop, which is kind of between us and Austin.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd been seeing what was happening there, but a lot of that is forest and not very much farmland. I mean, it's still devastating, obviously, but it wasn't affecting a lot of farmers. On Labor Day Monday, I was actually off farm running errands, and on my way home from the highway, I could see this huge plume of smoke. And I'm not really good at direction, but I looked at it and thought, oh, that's our town on fire. And I was still about 30, 40 miles away at the time. So I called Christian. This was Labor Day Monday. And I said, hey, I think our town's on fire. And he's like, what are you talking about? And it turned out our town was on fire. He went outside and looked, and based on where we were on our farm, it looked like it was maybe 5 miles away. The town we live in, it's extremely tiny. We're 45 miles northwest of Houston, but we're so small it's not even a town. But oddly enough, there are 3 grade A goat dairies in our little town field store. And where the plume of smoke was looked suspiciously close to the other two, who happened to be friends of ours also. So Christian called up both farms and said, hey, step out your door and tell me if you guys are in some kind of trouble. And at that time, everyone, we'd had a previous fire in June that was put out successfully after a couple days. And so nobody was really all that amped up about this, but everyone kind of kept their eye on it. By that evening, though, things got really bad, and they both called back and said, yeah, not only is it getting close, the sheriff just came to the door and said, we have to go now. So we took in both grade A dairy farmers and all of their goats. So by 7 p.m. on Labor Day Monday, we had our normal farm of 29 goats, had goats coming in nonstop until by 10 o'clock there were over 80 additional goats that don't belong to us.
Wow.
Crazy story.
Yeah.
they're totally heroes. I think, you know, something that we wanted to touch on a little bit that was a big issue in 2011 was just the weather in general. It really caused havoc for a lot of farmers all across the country and all across the world. I mean, in Texas, we had these wildfires, Hurricane Irene devastated, you know, farms and pasture land all across the Northeast. And it's just a big issue, one that, you know, if the Mayans are right, and they seem to be pretty right, is only going to get trickier.
Yeah.
with the passage of time. But we're going to actually have Christian and Lisa on the second part of the show to tell us a little bit about how the farm has fared since the fire and what's going on with them right now. I think actually this is a good time to take a quick break. We're just about the midpoint of the show. When we come back, we're going to talk about cheese-related news in 2011 and then check in with the Seegers and with Kathleen Cotter.
We'll be right back.
And we are back on our New Year's roundup episode of Cutting the Curd.
It was a very exciting break.
I'm more excited than than I was before the break. So we've been going over our favorite episodes from 2011. Now we're going to, we're going to be talking later in the segment with Christian and Lisa Seeger of Blue Heron Farm. And we're also going to be following up with Kathleen Cotter of the Bloomy Rind in Nashville, Tennessee, who was on our show earlier in the year. But before we get to them, we're just going to go through some quick cheesy news from 2011. So let's Sophie lead it off.
Let's see. Okay, so we already mentioned the Hurricane Irene and our Vermont cheesemakers was a pretty big story and really affected some of the dairy farmers and cheesemakers all across the Northeast.
Although it's funny, it seems like that was mostly most of the damage, thankfully, damaged pasture land, it seemed like, for our farms anyways.
Yeah.
And the biggest damages, or the biggest, you know, hardship oftentimes was that there was no electricity.
Yeah.
So it's actually interesting. For instance, one farm, considered Bardwell Farm, decided to just invest in a giant generator, and now they're kind of like good, you know. If there's ever another bad storm, they can sort of keep on keeping on.
It's good for all of us.
Yes. Another cheesy news story. This year, 2011, the American Cheese Society had its annual conference in Montreal, which was the first time that the conference was ever held in a foreign country.
And then a little bit after the ACS conference, we had the first American Cheese Month, which was for the month of October. And we featured here in New York the New York Passport Program. It was one of the first times that, you know, all of the major cheese shops in New York were really working together, and you could go to any of these shops and support ACS and education programs. Patrick?
Can I jump in here?
Sure.
I always think that big conferences like that should be done in the equivalent of, like, third world places for that culture. Carlo Petrini always wanted to do his big meetings in like Africa and Cuba and places like that. I mean, Montreal has got so much good stuff going on. What about like Tennessee, Atlanta, you know, and then you invite general public, have a big fair.
Yeah.
It's harder to do that, I know.
It's going to be in Raleigh this year, you know, southern.
And we'll have to ask Kathleen. This year was the first year of, I believe it was called the Southern Artisan Cheesemakers Festival. Southern Artisan Cheese Festival that she helped produce. So
that's exciting. Tell us about that.
Yes, we had the first ever Southern Artisan Cheese Festival. We invited cheesemakers from around the Southeast, and we had 14 or 15, and then a few that couldn't make it who sent cheese, and we had some cheesemongers represent them in their stead, and it was fantastic. We sold it out at 750 tickets, and everybody loved it and was super into talking with the cheesemakers and learning and tasting, and so it'll be bigger and better this next year.
Well, congrats. That's awesome. Yeah. That is very, very cool.
Also, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good to be back.
The American Cheese Month, all the programs that were happening, a lot of them were raising funds for the American Cheese Education Foundation, which is a sister organization to the ACS, for their certification program. 2012 is going to be the first time ever that cheesemongers can be certified in the art of cheesemongering if they pass an exam, which is going to be administered at the American Cheese Society Conference in Raleigh in August. And spaces are going fast. So if anybody out there wants to register or learn more, just go to cheesesociety.org, and you can learn more about what the certification means and how to sign up for the exam. It's kind of an important, I feel like, step in the cheese industry.
Yeah.
It's like sommeliers, you know, you kind of have to be able to, I don't know, measure somehow how much cheese knowledge you have.
Yeah.
And then last but not least,
Cheesemonger Invitational.
Which was a huge success. This year
was really fun.
It was really fun. It was basically a big party, and some people were cutting quarter pound pieces of cheese on the stage. And the winner this year of the Cheesemonger Invitational was Steve Jones of the Cheese Bar in Portland. And I personally can't wait for the 2012 edition. It's pretty hilarious.
Yeah, we'll have to see what Adam has up his sleeve. It'll be interesting.
Oh, I'm sure plenty. All right. Well, let's check in with our guests. So our first guest that we would like to check in with is Kathleen Cotter. We talked with her back in the...
I think it was April.
In the spring. Yeah.
April or May.
And since our last show, you have actually opened a brick and mortar shop in Nashville, Tennessee.
Yeah, so I met sort of by happenstance two guys who were working to open a whole animal locally sourced butcher shop. And I proposed the idea. I told them what I was doing and what I had been doing, which was selling the market, and said, you know, I really wanted a permanent home. And so we just kind of put our heads together and explored a way in which the Bloomy Rind could keep its... I could keep the Bloomy Rind, but be within their space. I feel like Nashville is not a town where people are used to going to specialty shops and making those extra stops instead of getting everything at a grocery store. So all along, I was trying to find a way to make it where you might have specialty stops, but maybe two birds and with one stone, which is, you know, sort of the perfect thing. So people, you know, what they're doing and what I do, we have very similar philosophies, so we're going to appeal to the same customer base, we felt. And so we put, so I have a cheese case, so I have sort of a little counter within the butcher shop. So it's their business, and my business is within it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. What's the name of the butcher shop?
It's Porter Road Butcher.
Porter Road Butcher. Well, I think that's really great. It's a great way for you to consolidate, like you said, customers, because people who are looking for your kinds of products, if they can get everything in one spot, you know, all of their delicious meat and dairy, that's wonderful. And it also shares the risk a little bit for both of you entrepreneurs, because opening a business is, it's not an easy thing. So if you can kind of go in on it with somebody,
yeah,
that's a good deal.
Absolutely. And I got incredibly fortunate that they were open to it, and they were farther along and as far as gathering financing and then building out a space, and so they were a year ahead of me and all of that. So it was just an incredibly fortunate thing for me to be able to do, for sure.
And so what was it like to open a retail store during the month of December?
Yeah. Haven't you only been open for 2 weeks?
It's the smartest idea ever, right?
Yeah. It's like jump into the deep end of the pool times like 2000.
And then paddle as hard as you can. So we did some soft opening dates around Thanksgiving and, early December. And then we opened on December 13th. And it was crazy and busy and fun and exciting. And I pretty much ran out of cheese right at or just after Christmas. So I learned a little bit about, you know, buying more than I expect to sell. And and then I quickly restocked in between Christmas and New Year's and, you know, sold a bunch more. So, and it was, you know, we just sort of, you know, I think prepared everyone for we're new at this and we'll do our best. And most people were gracious and patient and just excited that both the butcher shop and the cheese shop are here. And so mostly it was great, and there were, you know, of course, some hiccups, but all in all, it was good, and it was nice to get those sales, you know, in the beginning of our process instead of starting in
August
probably be
or
a little
something.
Bit quieter, yeah. Right?
Are you selling
or January? So.
Are you selling mostly southern cheeses, or are you, how did you kind of curate your selection?
I actually, this was sort of inspired by Anne's shop that I visited way back when I started my process, and the fact that she focused on regional and domestically made cheeses, it kind of felt like it would be a really, it was more accessible to me as someone starting out in this instead of trying to know all the cheeses of the world. And it was a way that I could support farmers who I would get to know and who were making cheese sustainably, which was really important to me. So I focus on the region, but not exclusively. I definitely carry things from other parts. Just we don't have quite the cheesemaker density that other more cheese-centric regions have. So I focus on it. I highlight it. We did the festival, but there's definitely some awesome Vermont and New York and Oregon and California cheeses in the mix, so, and Wisconsin.
That's great. And so I was wondering, how do you think that the cheese culture in Nashville is changing since you started, you know, your work with the Bloomy Rind at the markets till now?
Well, Nashville's a town that's, it's hard to meet somebody who grew up here. So we definitely are a city that has a lot of implants from other places. So a lot of people who are attracted to both the butcher shop and the cheese shop are from other places up north, for example. And so this is something that they're used to and they're very excited about. And I think it's been just kind of the trend and the movement that we're seeing everywhere, I think, of people caring more about what they're eating and where it comes from and asking questions and learning. And so it's something that's going on here as well as other places. And so we're just, you know, the beneficiaries, and we get to help grow it as well. So
that's really, really exciting. Well, yeah. Congratulations to you. I can't wait to come visit. You gotta get to Nashville.
And thanks for taking time to talk to us.
Thank you.
All right. Well, we are going to check in also with now Christian and Lisa Seeger from Blue Heron Farm. Are you guys on the line?
Yeah, I'm here. Christian's out farming.
Somebody's got to do the dirty work, right?
Yeah. And I prefer it be him.
So tell us, how has the rest of your fall and winter been? Has the weather calmed down a little bit? Are things back to normal on the farm?
We're about as normal ever get. We actually managed to get some rain in November and also in December. December is usually our wettest month here, so we're still under normal, but it's been this amazing thing that the rains came and grass is growing in December, which it shouldn't. This is not the season for grass, but we'll take it anytime we can get it, and it's made us really hopeful for next year.
That's great.
Yeah,
that's great. And so I was wondering, you know, how has the public response been to your farm after doing the wildfire Chev? Has there been, have you guys experienced a big influx in sales or attention from the community that you didn't have before?
We definitely have gotten a lot more PR out of it. I think it's one of those things that you can be anonymous forever, but once you get attention, then, you know, people don't have to look very hard to find you. So our biggest and most fun thing is the Minister of Propaganda, as we like to call him, came to our farm. Voice of America did a profile on our farm, and Voice of America is the State Department's channel that they show abroad.
Wow.
So I guess we're ambassadors for goat herding across the world now.
Congrats. That's amazing. When you said Minister of Propaganda, Oh, no, when you said Minister of Propaganda, I thought you maybe were talking about some, like, goofy character from Austin or something. I didn't know you really meant the Minister of Propaganda.
Yeah, no, it really is the Minister of Propaganda. And I called him that when he was here because I have an inability to filter sometimes, but he seemed really okay with that.
Oh, that's amazing. And so, and how about your neighbors? How are they faring? Yeah. Are their farms okay, and are they back kind of in normal production?
Yeah, you know, everybody is back. Everybody has experienced decreased production this year, and, you know, it's so hard to tell how much of it would be the fire and how much of it would just be the crushing drought. I mean, the nutrition that our animals get is subpar this year because of the drought, so it's really not easy to know where the blame lies, but all of us are down a little, and now, of course, seasonally, because we all practice seasonal farming, we're all down for the winter. But all of us noticed a decrease in production, and it's just, you know, it's just really hard to pinpoint, but we're all still chugging along, and we're all still in business. So, I mean, that's what's most important.
And when are you going to get started up again for the spring?
Well, we're starting our kidding February 10th. On a normal year, we would have started a little sooner, but our breeding had to be postponed when we had 120 random animals running around. So we started right. breeding about 2 weeks, 3 weeks after everybody left. So our babies will start coming February 10th, and the milk will pick up steadily starting then. So we're really looking forward to it. But I don't know, low season has its perks too. So
yeah, a little downtime is always a good thing.
Yeah.
So are you guys taking any kind of special precautions for next year or doing anything differently planning-wise to anticipate any other sort of, you know, weather-related problems?
One of the things we did is we actually bought a semi-load of hay from out of state
when everything started getting really scarce and really scary, we bought, half a load, so 13 huge round bales. And normally that would be a whole year's supply for us. And we just thought better safe than sorry. So we've got many tons of hay sitting in our barnyard now and covered with a tarp. And so in a worst-case scenario, we're going to have something to feed our goats. But short of that, well, I guess we'll try rain dancing and just be really optimistic.
Yeah. Well, if you've got some good rains coming your way now, hopefully that'll continue.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, man. Well, thanks so much for taking the time to check back in, and glad to hear that everything is going well. And we're almost out of time on the show, but we couldn't start, you know, the new year without extolling the nutritional virtues of cheese.
And reminding everyone how good it is for you. So you can keep eating it in 2012.
Yeah, exactly. Everybody always, like, you know, parties hard, eats lots of good food, drinks a lot, hangs out with their friends. And then, you know, come January, everyone wants to, you know, turn over a new leaf. But we think, you know, you can still eat the cheese.
Yeah, cheese is part of the new leaf.
Yeah. we actually found a really funny article online. Actually, Mike, our cave manager, found a funny article online in the Hindustani Times, saying that cheese, they were actually doing a cheese diet versus a butter diet, and both of those are kind of questionable, but the cheese diet is apparently better for you than the butter diet.
Yes. And this is via the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition.
That's so true.
It's got some data to back it up, I think.
Exactly. Well, so basically, they were saying that after the 6 weeks diet of, you know, lots of cheese, more than you would usually consume, the people that were on the cheese diet had lower levels of both of the bad cholesterol.
Yeah.
I can never remember which is which. But so that was, you know, that was good. Cheese and cholesterol, you know, you can just throw that one out the window. Don't have to worry about it. And then we also looked at a presentation that I actually attended at the American Cheese Society conference this year. It was actually a really funny presentation. There was this French gentleman who was just really, really convinced that, you know, there's nothing wrong with cheese and it was really, really healthy for you and really good. And, you know, saturated fatty acids are things that people, you know, often demonize when they're talking about, you know, eating too much cheese and fatty dairy. However, he was emphasizing that there are many different kinds of saturated fatty acids. And actually, the kinds in cheese are good for you, whereas the kinds found in, like, you know, processed vegetable oils, palm oil, corn oil, those kinds of things, those can be problematic.
Yes.
But, you know, so cheese is okay. And finally, you know, they were emphasizing that milk in itself is such a nutrient dense substance. You know, scientists can't even understand all the parts of it and all the beneficial little things that are locked up inside the matrix. And especially raw milk. It's full of natural flora and fauna that have tons of health benefits, including for your immunity, for allergies, and also, again, you know, it says reduction of cholesterol. So
there you have it.
Who needs Lipitor? Just eat some cheese.
Yeah.
Well, I think that'll do it for our 2011 roundup. We can't wait for 2012. And we'll see you next Monday on the Heritage Radio Network.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. On December 17th, Typhoon Sendang dropped over 180 millimeters of rain in less than 24 hours and caused severe flash flooding to the northern Mindanao region of the Philippines. The cities of Iligan and Cagayan de Oro City were hit the worst, and the area has suffered severe damage and human loss. 654 people have been claimed dead, hundreds more are missing, and nearly 100,000 Filipinos have been displaced after the floodwaters destroyed everything in its path during the late hours of the night. The city's power and water supplies were shut down for nearly 24 hours, and many Filipinos need your help. Xavier University is accepting donations to help those in need.
please visit www.sendongrelief.org for more information. That's www.sendongrelief.org.